Okay, good morning. Let's see. So the plan for today is to continue with the mean value theorem today and also Friday, some more applications of the mean value theorem. And what I want to focus on today is what it tells us about our functions, in particular, the functions that are derivatives, and then later functions that have n derivatives. I'll finish up with such a thing. So using the mean value theorem to understand functions. In particular, we can answer a few of the questions that we've had, at least that I've had and have asked in class about which functions we can show are derivatives and which ones, which is actually not the harder part. The harder part is showing, well, so far, the harder part is showing that they're not derivatives. So we can find a way to identify that certain functions are not derivatives. Okay, and what this is similar to what was done in the previous term with continuous functions, okay? So I want to compare what we can say about functions which are derivatives to functions which are continuous. I think I got all your names down, Canvas run. All right, so we're gonna compare functions which are derivatives is a long phrase, and therefore I have a shortening of it. I just call it D0, to continuous functions. And what was covered in the last term for these continuous functions. So let me just recall a couple of facts about continuous functions. And then we can indicate how those are related. And the main thing, actually, I will come up with a proof, but the main thing is actually examples, so that you know what examples you have to use. All right, and so the setup, I guess, is that we'll talk about the image. So let me just recall. Oops. So we will consider the setup where we have but hopefully that can be fixed. There we go. So A is less than C is less than D is less than B. So we'll have these two nested intervals, A, B, and C, D. The idea being that we'll take an open interval here and a closed interval there. So that's going to be our picture. All right, so and write, if we have some function here defined on, as I just advertised, this open interval AB, well, CD is something smaller, and we can write IM for the image. And if I write this little vertical bar, that means that I'm restricting my function to CD. So this is the set of symbols that I'm going to write just to mean the set of all values f of x such that x is between C and D. Maybe I'll just write it that way, actually, instead of elements. All right, between, and it can be equal. That's why we have square braces. Okay, so that's the notation that I will be using. All right, and so then the theorems that I would like to find analogs for or not, whether one's true and one isn't, that were true for continuous functions are the following. So if this one, I guess, is 7.35 in the text. Okay, so if I have a continuous function, on this open interval AB, and then just as before, I'm going to restrict it to this smaller closed interval. Then the image, so the set of values that this function can take, image of F restricted to CD. Actually, can anyone remember any facts about such an image that you covered last term? So what are some restrictions? facts that have to be true for the image of a continuous function. If I have a continuous function, so here's my continuous function, and I take its image, so those are all the values that my function takes on. What restrictions does that have? That makes sense. So I'm here. I have a closed interval CD, and I have a continuous function on that closed interval. And I want to look at all the values that that function takes on. Right? So the image of that function. And so I claim there are some restrictions. Let me just mention a few. So these all come from the previous term. So the first one is that it's closed and bounded. Actually, I guess that's two. Okay. And one result of that is that there's always a whenever I have this continuous function, there's always a point where it reaches its maximum, and a point where it reaches its minimum. Okay, because that's one of the things that having a closed image tells us, that it hits both the top and the bottom, right? Because it's closed and bounded. Okay, and the second theorem is 7.44. It's also connected, so I can't have a gap. Okay, so if same hypotheses, so we have this continuous function, then same object I'm gonna study, the F restricted to CD is connected. Okay, so that tells us the upshot is that if f is continuous, then the image of this f restricted to CD is just a closed interval. And it's the closed interval from f evaluated at some point little m to f evaluated at some point big M, the values at which it takes on its maximum minimum. So it's always a closed interval like this, or I guess they could be equals and it's a point. Okay, so that's all you can get with continuous functions. Now, but remember that in the setting of derivatives, not all derivatives are continuous, right? We've had some examples in class that they're not continuous. And so it's a more general class, and it may not satisfy both, and it doesn't satisfy both. And so let me indicate the new theorem. So this is old. This is what this was from the previous term. And let me just indicate now the new theorems. So new theorem. Okay, and so the first ones are that this one, you just indicate this is going to fail, but this is still going to be true. Okay, so that's what we're going to get. One is fails and the other is now true. So this remains true. So theorem, if we have a derivative let me phrase it differently, because I want the extensional quantifier. Let me rewrite it, because this one's going to be false. I'm going to switch the existential quantifier. So there is, okay, f in d0 ab, right, with the image when I restrict it to this closed interval CD, not bounded. And B, there's such a thing with the image not closed. Okay. But C, and this is the Darboux theorem, The other fact that it's connected remained true. So if f is a derivative, just as the case of being continuous, then this image, when restricted to a closed interval, is connected. Okay, so that's what we get. Some of it stays true and some of it fails. Okay, so we'll be able to come up with examples. It's good to have some in mind. You might try to think about some. Actually, I'll put this on the homework so you can build a group of examples to keep in mind. Okay, and so, but this thing I'm gonna talk about now is this fact that remains true, the Darboux theorem. Okay, and that's gonna enable us to answer a couple of questions. So, corollary. Well, this is an example. Let's say that we have a function which only takes two values. It takes exactly two values. If f is a function taking exactly two values, then it can't be a derivative function because two points are not connected. F is not a derivative. And we've seen functions like this. In fact, that was one of the questions. If I take f of x equal to either one or zero, one sometimes zero, sometimes that's only two values, one and zero. And so that one can't be a derivative. So I could take, for example, if it's one with x bigger than zero and zero with x less than or equal to zero. So that's this function here. That's not a derivative. Okay. So it's not a derivative function. Similarly, of course, another class that we have ended up with is something that's one and x is equal to zero and otherwise not. So again, this is, again, the type of function which has exactly two values. And so these are not derivative functions, okay? So this is, we could get close to that first function, right? By taking the absolute value function, taking its derivative, but that was different because it was not defined here at zero, okay? Okay, so we found a way to eliminate. So let me give one corollary to this. So corollary, let's say that we have two functions that differ only at one point. So otherwise they're the same. And okay, so if we have two derivative functions, so f and g are derivative functions. So they're in this d0 on some interval a, b. And I have some point, let's say e in this interval. And they agree, except possibly that point. So for all x different from e, we have that f of x is equal to a g of x. Then I claim that, in fact, they are actually equal everywhere. Okay, even though these functions need not be continuous, okay, it's still true that they must actually be equal at E. And let me just prove this and then run through an example. Okay, so we're trying to make use of this fact that if I had a function with exactly two values, that it was not a derivative. So can anyone see how I can use these two functions to build something like up here that has just two values so that I can prove this? Let's draw a little sketch here. So I have my two functions. Here's E. Now one function, and then I have another function that looks exactly the same, except here it's got some other value, and it keeps going. So these two graphs look very similar, f and g, except they differ right here at this one point. Okay, so I want to take those two functions and build a new function. Okay, and remember that all my function spaces are linear, so I can take linear combinations, so I can take their difference. All right, so let me start with the difference. And so what do I know about the difference of those two functions? Proof, since f and g are different, are derivative functions, we have f minus g is a derivative function. What is f minus g? What are the values that that takes on?
It's zero for all x except when it's not e.
Exactly. All right, does everyone see that? Because my functions agree, except at that one point e. And they're different at e, so it takes some different value, which is going to be f at e minus g at e, which is not zero, when x is equal to e, right? So this is not zero here because they're different. Okay, so my function takes on precisely two values. And as above, that means that it's not, in fact, a derivative function. So I would get a contradiction. So if, let me just write that up more carefully. So if f of e is different from g of e, then this function here takes exactly two values and is hence not a derivative function. That's a contradiction because we just said that it was. So, f minus g is not in d0, a contradiction. Right, because now I've got on the board here, I've got that it is in there, and I've got that it's not in there, right? So that's contradiction. Okay, very good. So that's handy. It gives us some examples of functions that are not derivatives that would otherwise be hard to spot. And let me just give one example, which I will put on the homework for you to prove some facts about, but it's a good one to remember. So let me just remind you, list it now also. And so e.g., if I take the function x squared, now let me call this f of x. So x squared sine of 1 over x and 0. So this makes sense as long as x is non-zero and then it's 0 and x is 0. So this is a function we've seen before, right? And this function we computed its derivative, right, is differentiable. So this is in D1. Right, and we computed it. That f prime of x, and we just computed what it is. I'll just write it out again. So 2x sine of 1 on x minus cosine of 1 on x when x is non-zero and zero otherwise. And since we just wrote it as a derivative, of course, that means it's a derivative function. The definition. All right, so this is a derivative, but if I change it at one point, then it's not. That's what it tells me. So the function g of x equals exactly the same thing when x is not zero and say a half when x is equal to zero, therefore is not a derivative function. So even though my function, if I were to graph this f prime, remember it looks kind of like this. the this new function still satisfies the intermediate value property, but it's not a derivative function. So that'll be on your homework. Okay, so any questions about why that gives us an example of a function that's not a derivative function?
I had a question on like the corollary or like,
okay.
It's not like, I guess more my question is like, can we generalize it to like any finite number of points?
Yes, very good. Yes, in fact, you can do that. That is correct. Yes, very good. Other comments or questions? Okay. All right, so we've made a little bit of juice this Darboux theorem to get some examples. Let me just prove it now. So proof of Darboux theorem. Okay, so the first thing to notice is that there's another way to state it, which is longer. Some people find it more intuitive, so I would like to get both written down, and it's easier to write out a proof for, so let me state it that way. So instead of simply saying that this is connected, let's be a little bit more explicit and look at the values that it achieves at C, the value that it achieves at D. So this will be F of D, and this will be F of C, and we have some alpha here in between, and then the claim is that that's equal to some f of e, right? That's what it means to be, for the image to be connected. Whenever I have a value here and a value here, then it's connected. And actually, since my functions are supposed to be derivative functions, I can do a little bit better, and I can even write this as the derivative of something, right? Because it's a derivative function. So this will be capital F prime at D, and this will be capital F prime at C. So that's the way I'm gonna write it, right? So let me write that out. All right, so equivalently, so the theorem is equivalent to all right. So instead of starting with a derivative, I'm going to start with something that's differentiable and then take its derivative. So for all capital Fs, which are differentiable, okay, so then the derivative is going to be my little f. And of course I'll be in exactly the same setup as always. So I'm gonna have a smaller interval CD sitting inside of my bigger interval AB, well, it's defined, okay? I have alpha lying between the derivative evaluated at C and D. I already have a verb. Alpha between capital F prime at C and capital F prime at D. There is some E inside of this interval from C to D with F prime at E being this alpha value, so alpha is a G. So as you can see, that's a longer statement, but I hope it's clear that that's the same as saying that the image is connected, the image of its derivative is connected, okay? All right, so that's the part, that's the way I'm gonna prove it, is in this second form. Okay, so proving this form. All right, so let's assume that we're in that setting, and try to find that E. All right, so actually, let me just draw a little sketch here. So let me do a little bit of simplification first. All right. So first of all, there are two possible cases when I write this between. It could be that it goes up, or it could be that it goes down. They're similar, but I'll just choose one of them and leave the other. So either F prime at C is less than alpha, which is less than F prime at D, or of course the other way around. Okay, and of course these are going to be similar. This one I will look at below. So consider below. And this one is similar, so I'll just leave it. Okay, and just look at the second case. All right. All right, so we're in this second case where the derivatives are falling. And now I want to get rid of this alpha business. So there's an alpha here, right? I want to kind of get rid of it. And just like we did when we moved from the Rolle's theorem to the mean value theorem, we just took something flat and kind of slanted it. And that's what we're going to do again. We're just going to slant it back until it's flat. And so to do that, I will consider capital G of X to be capital F of X slanted back. So I'm going to just subtract off this alpha X. So then we get that G prime, of course, is just equal to F prime minus this alpha. Of course, again, we have this linear space and I've just added something which we know is a derivative. So this again is going to be something which, I'm sorry, it's a differentiable. So this is again going to be some differentiable function just like before. And so I can take its derivative and get something which is a derivative just like before. Okay, so I can do that. Okay, and so now I can get rid of this alpha. So G prime of C is then greater than zero, which is greater than G prime of D. And this again is the case that I just advertised I was going to do. So this is this case here. Okay. Subtract it off of everything. All right, and then finally, is it clear what the goal is? So what do I want the derivative of G at E to be? Yeah, okay, where did the zero come from? So what I did was I took alpha here and subtracted it from all three. So I took a minus alpha here, a minus alpha here, and a minus alpha here. Okay. And that gave me this. Okay, is everyone following the setup? So again, it's a lot like the move between Rolle's theorem and the mean value theorem. Okay, and so then what's the goal gonna be for G prime at E? So remember what
is it showing that it's zero? Because we
that's exactly alpha. Right. Okay. You got it exactly right. Yeah, that's right. Because as you said, we subtract that alpha from both. Yeah. So that's the goal. So we're trying to find a derivative of zero. But we have techniques for finding derivatives that are zero, right? So we can use it. So we want this to be equal to zero. And if I sketch my situation here, let's see. So this says that I have a positive derivative at C here, right? And I have a negative derivative up here at D, right? And my function does something in between, all right? And my goal is to find some E where I have a zero derivative, okay? That's my goal. So what would be a good choice for that E? How do I find values where my functions take a derivative that's zero?
The max or the min?
Exactly, that's right. So I'm gonna try to take that to be like the maximum, okay? And so let's just try to do that. So, so since G is in D1, so it's differentiable, which is contained in C0, so it's continuous, by 7.37, there are, as you say, values at which it takes the max and min. There exists a capital M with, let me see where that capital M is. Of course, it's inside of the closed interval, and that's our biggest problem between C and D. With G of M equal to the maximum of the image of G restricted to CD, right? Because it's continuous, since that's something that we didn't know exists. All right, so case A, if this is actually not at either of the endpoints, but it's in the interior, then we have our interior extremum theorem of Fermat, and that tells us that that has a derivative of zero at that point, and we are done. Then by the internal extremum theorem, we have G prime at M is equal to zero. So take E equals M, and we're done. Okay. All right, but of course there are two other points. It could be C and it could be D. So case C, if M is equal to C, and D if M is equal to D. So of course those are going to be similar. This one is going to be similar to C. So I'll just do one of them just like before, and then the other one's similar. Okay. So this is the one that I'm going to work with below. Okay, so let me look. So if I look here, could it be that my maximum value is achieved here at C? So I'm going to try to get a contradiction. Why is that a contradiction? So remember, there's only one thing we know about C, right? And that is that the derivative is positive there. So I claim it's not possible, because if we take another point that's nearby, this X here, it's going to, because the derivative is positive, it's going to be a bigger value, okay? Yeah, exactly, as in the chat there. The derivative is increasing. The derivative is positive, so the function's increasing, and so it has to be smaller there at C than it is nearby, okay? And that's exactly the correct intuition, and we just have to turn that into a formal proof, but that's the intuition. Okay, so let's do that. All right, so let's work on this case. Then we will get a contradiction by getting x with g of x bigger than g of c, which is supposed to be equal to g of m, contradicting the choice of m. Right, which is supposed to be the biggest. So that's going to be where we get our contradiction. All right, so let's just try that. So we know that the derivative here is positive. So compute. So zero is less than my derivative, g prime at c. Okay, and now I can just write out what that means. So this is just the limit x approaches c of the difference quotient. So g at x minus g at c divided by x minus c. Okay, now that derivative is equal to this number, but we only care about the values to the right of c. And so if the limit is that, then the right limit is that and the left limit is that, and I only care about one of them. So I'm gonna take the right limit. Okay, so I hope you agree that's still true. If I just take the right limit, it's still equal to the same thing, okay? And so that's the one I'm gonna look at. Okay, now if I take the right limit, then what do I have? So this is positive, okay? What's the sign of this x minus c if I'm looking at the right limit? That one's also positive. Okay, and so all I want is that this is positive, and that's very plausible, right? Because otherwise I'd have a negative thing whose limit was positive. And that's not gonna happen. Okay, so let me just write out carefully how we do that, but that's what I need to do. All right, so, okay, so I do this computation and for all epsilon greater than zero, there exists a delta greater than zero. And actually I can take delta to be smaller than something if I want. So let me take it to be smaller than d minus c so I don't fall off the edge of my interval. And whenever I take an x and I'm taking a right limit, so x is between c and c plus delta. Okay, so it's in that little interval to the right of c. Then we have that our limit here is our difference quotient is getting close to the limit. And so if I take the difference between the limit, so g prime at c minus this difference quotient, so g at x minus g at c divided by x minus c, this is smaller than epsilon. Okay, so I hope everyone agrees that that is what having that right limit tells me. Okay. It's actually also bigger than negative epsilon, but I don't need that. Okay, and so now we can just combine. So now I get to make a choice of epsilon and then we can combine. So choose, this is true for every epsilon. So I can take epsilon to be say half of G prime. Of course, G prime is positive, so is half of it. So we have this bigger than half. And then any, of these x's. And then I just summarize what I get here. So we have that this epsilon is now g prime over two. So I'm gonna bring it over here to the left and move this negative term over to the right. And I get one half of g prime of c. Of course that's, and then I'm gonna cross multiply. I'm gonna multiply by this x minus c. And then this is going to be less than g of x minus g of c. And let's see, so this thing is positive, this is positive, so the whole thing is positive, just as we argued up above. And I have succeeded, okay? By getting the advertised contradiction. Okay, any questions about that argument? So that's the complete argument. Okay. All right, so this enables us to figure out something about what derivatives can look like. And they're a little bit more general than continuous functions, but they have some of the same properties. They're not just arbitrary functions. And this is, so they sort of live in this world in between. So the next theorem then that I want to look at, and I will only have time to state it and do some, maybe time for a little bit of an example. And then next time I'll prove it, but it's also familiar from Math 21. But now we're going to make use of it in a slightly different way, and so it's important to remind ourselves of it, and we're also going to prove it, which we didn't do there. This is Taylor's polynomials. And actually, we're gonna use them quite a bit in this class, and we're gonna look at two different types of error, that different ways of estimating the error in these polynomials. And one of them we'll do now, and one at the end of the class. And so this one is with Lagrange style error. Okay, another one later. Okay, so that's where we are. And let me just remind you of some of the notation. Definition. And this time we're gonna have a better function than just a derivative. This one's gonna have n derivatives. So if f is n times differentiable, and we have some point, okay, where at which we want to study our function, around which actually we wish to study our function. Then we write P sub n. Sometimes you just write P sub n. For today, let me add an extra C just to keep it in the notation, just so it's clear. Although often that gets dropped. And this is the standard Taylor polynomial that you may or may not recall from earlier calculus, but let me write it out. So it's we're going to evaluate our function at the point C, and then we're going to, so that's just a number, and now we're going to make it the polynomial. So now we're going to put in a linear term. So the linear term is going to be this number f prime at C times x minus C, and then we're going to put in a quadratic term. So that's going to be this number f double prime at C divided by 2 factorial, which is just 2, times the square. But the 2 factorial is supposed to be suggestive. So then we can keep going. And the last term is going to be the nth derivative evaluated at C, it's some number, divided by n factorial, another number, times the polynomial of degree n. So x minus c to the n. And so although it looks long and complicated, the idea is that this is supposed to be an easy function because it's just a polynomial, all right? And this is supposed to be a complicated function because we don't know much about it. The only thing we know is that it has n derivatives, okay? So that's the goal. So this is our estimate. And then so finally we will write R for the difference, the remainder term. And let me add a bunch of subscripts here, although often one just writes R, but it's nice to keep track of everything that's going on here. So there's the number of terms and the point about which we're expanding and the value of X. And this will just be the difference between our function evaluated at X and this simple polynomial that we're using to try to approximate it, also evaluated at X. So this is the error. Or actually the other term people use is remainder, let me write it that. And I may use it also, so a remainder. Okay, right. So those are the objects of interest. Okay, and so let me just write down the theorem, and let's see, then if we have time, I can do one quick example. And then next time prove it. So the theorem is that we can express this R in some particularly nice way. And so if we're in the above situation, so f is n times differentiable, because we need to take those n derivatives to write it out. And we have a c and also some x that's inside of this regime where it's defined. So between a and b. Then, and much like what we had above, there is some, instead of alpha, let me write another Greek letter, zeta, between C and X, where we can write out this error or a remainder part. Okay, And so the idea is that it's, it looks a lot like we just took the next term. But of course, if we just took the next term, we just have a slightly better approximation. We're still not going to be there, right? Because our function isn't actually derivative. So it's a lot like the next term, but not quite. And it's important to note it, what's slightly different about it. And so it's going to be, so we're going to take the n plus first derivative. That's the same. We're going to divide by n plus one factorial. That's the same. We're going to multiply by x minus c to the n plus 1. That's the same. And then the only thing that's different between this and the next term is that we're going to evaluate this derivative at this number zeta, okay, instead of at c, where we would have in the next term of the expansion. Okay, so that's the only difference here. All right. And so let me just note, so the hardest thing about using this is that there's very little information about zeta. Okay, so it's not clear which value that is. But if it's enough to know that it's inside of that interval, then you can get quite a bit of information. And so let me just note a few examples here. So examples, which I will, you can think about, and I'll say more about them next time, but we can take, so that they have to have at least n derivatives. So they can't be really terrible functions. They got to have at least n derivatives. And so let me give you some that have actually have a lot of derivatives. So let's take f of x equals e to the x is a good example. F of x equals 1 over x, x to the minus 1 is another a good example. These are both good examples, but they behave very differently. And so it's worth trying a few examples of values for these. So these behave differently. But both of them are interesting. And so you might just try a few examples of those or remind yourself what the power series looks like for those, because next time we'll play with some examples using those and then prove this theorem. Okay, about out of time here. Any questions about anything? All right, then I think I will stop the recording, and I'll stick around in case there are further questions for after class.